There Is a Love, the name of the song. Music from Jim Cole. Also, we heard from Paul Wilbur, I Lift Up My Eyes. That's from his 1995 Live Jerusalem concert, the album entitled Shalom Jerusalem. And we heard the African Music Experience with Above All. And it's 12 and a half past the hour on this, a Tuesday morning. And, of course, that means a visit. We look forward to him every Tuesday. The Reverend Dr. John Delancey joins us from Glenshaw, Pennsylvania. John, good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
John is in charge of Biblical Israel Tours. He's a pastor in Glenshaw and a baseball umpire. So you got, what, 6 inches of snow over there?
Yeah, I had 3 games scheduled this week, but I don't think they are going to happen. But
well, you know, if you just brush off the area around the bases a little bit, you can see if they slide in, and you can call them safe out, or thawed, frozen. You know, you have a choice.
I think American League rules allow you to use snowshoes.
Yeah. I wonder if you could use a designated field like in Florida.
At least they allowed snowshoes in Minnesota.
John,
I think they have to change the color of the ball, though. Yeah,
that's true.
Bright neon. Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, well, actually, I've seen high school games here played because high school teams are getting cranked up pretty quick here, and I've seen them playing in snowfall, in puddles, and you know, big ice patches on the infield, and it makes for a pretty wild game. It's kind of baseball Minnesota style. So, this too shall pass, though, John. Spring will come. How's your spring cleaning coming?
Spring cleaning. What spring cleaning?
What spring? Well, you're supposed, it's the Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I just learned this morning. That's why I bring this up. The Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday after Palm Sunday are traditionally the days when all spring cleaning is done. And that, of course, derives from the Jewish custom of cleaning out your home for Passover. So you're down to a day and a half left. Huh? How you doing?
I am. Well, I'm looking for all those crumbs in the corner still, but you know, that's what my dog is here for, to try to hunt down everything
that's
that
we have. Why we have pets. Yeah, yes. We depend on ours that way, too. Dave and I were talking earlier about Tuesday night being a likely time for the actual Last Supper of Jesus and his disciples, and that has to do with the Jewish regulations by the Sanhedrin of having to consider a sentence of death, a capital punishment offense, for 24 hours before they come back to reaffirm it, and makes time. And but at some point, you know, Friday he was crucified, and they took him down from the cross and they put him someplace. And I've always wondered about this, because I know there were problems that, you know, the cleanliness laws, where Jews would be ceremonially unclean if they touched a dead body, for example. And I assume that extends to parts and bones and so forth. I'm curious. I see Jerusalem in that day as a very densely populated city, maybe not huge by today's standards, but still pretty densely built. You know, homes and shops close in, little narrow winding streets and stone walls. And what did they do with the bodies of people who had died? Did they take them outside the city, or did they bury them inside the city?
They were certainly buried outside the city. In fact, that's one argument that enters into the discussion about the location of the tomb of Christ. So we have primarily two locations, if you will. One is a traditional one that actually goes back even to the 4th century, and the other is a more recent one that goes back to about the 1880s. But the question is, the Jews, because they had to bury their dead outside the city walls, the question is, in the days of Jesus, where was that wall between the Antonia Fortress and what is now called the Jaffa Gate, or the area of Herod's palace? Josephus mentions that there was a wall that went in between these two structures that were prominent structures in the day of Christ. But today, because of the old city is so dense in modern-day structure, it's hard to knock on the door of someone and ask, hey, could we excavate underneath your house to see if we can find a wall? You just can't do that. But along the way, there are hints where this wall was, and primarily the location of what is called the Holy Sepulchre Church. In the lower reaches of this church, actually, there's about almost 24 Second Temple tombs, which means this traditional location for the tomb of Christ, named the Holy Sepulchre Church, was actually outside the city walls because of the presence of these kochim, or niche or Jewish tombs that date to the time of Christ.
Mm. And what was the actual practice when a family member died? They didn't go out and dig a hole 6 feet deep, put him in a box, and put him in the ground. Why was that? And I don't know where we get that as our custom here in the West, but they did it differently. How did they do it?
Well, they buried people in essentially caves so they could be reused. In the Old Testament, there were bench structure caves where there would be a chamber cut into the rock, and typically a bench triclinium form would be able to hold three deceased bodies, if you will, and then when the body would decay, the bones would literally be thrown in what is called a repository, sort of a cutout area below these bench structures. New Testament times, it varied a little because these bench structures with this repository weren't necessarily used. Instead, they used ossuaries. So again, a tomb could be reused after the body would be decayed. Of course, the bones then would be thrown into a stone box, brought out, given to the family, whatever, and then the tomb could be opened to anyone else. So people did not bury into the ground, but they buried in a cave because primarily these caves or tombs could be reused for generations.
Wouldn't the first impulse, it just seems to me the first impulse would be to bury somebody, though. Does the ground not permit it? Is it too hard to dig? You know, is there some physical reason why that wasn't their first option and this other custom developed, you know?
Well, certainly in Jerusalem and as well as other sites, the area of the issue of space was prominent. For instance, in the city of David, during the Old Testament times, across the Kidron Valley in the village of Soan, I've actually been in some of those Iron Age tombs or Old Testament tombs. They certainly were just natural openings, if you will, in the cliff, and they cut them out a little further and made a tomb out of them. Some of them have benches, some have a cornice, even decorated on the roof. So some of them are pretty elaborate. But I think the readiness of caves and openings like this was the leading reason why people buried their deceased in caves instead of, you know, burying them in the ground.
And apparently,
there just wasn't enough room.
Apparently the tradition was in place for a family, and I think of Abraham, buying a piece of land in order to provide for his burial and the burial of his descendants.
Yeah, we have that referenced in the book of Genesis, the cave of Machpelah. Again, it's a cave and not just the land where people were buried in the ground. But it's an interesting concept, and I think it's historically accurate to trace that method of burying people in a cave, even all the way through Old Testament history, leading up, of course, to the time of Christ.
But it suggests that these caves in which the burials occurred were private property. And even in this country now, there are private cemeteries, and such has happened in the last 200 years. But we think of Joseph of Arimathea, who apparently owned a cave that became the tomb for Jesus. So apparently he had provided for his family in that way by purchasing a burial site in advance.
He did, and that's interesting that the text in Matthew, I believe, it's Matthew who mentions that it was a newly hewn tomb. And that's a real significant piece of information, especially when we look at the tombs that are found around the Holy Sepulchre. A church was built there in the 4th century, Helena, in about 326 AD, to commemorate actually the area where Jesus, and specifically the area where Jesus was both crucified and buried. But the Protestants, I think motivated with a theological bias, actually suggested another site called today the Garden Tomb. And when you look at that tomb, it has a rolling stone. It's quite impressive. I love the site of the Garden Tomb. It's quiet. There's a garden. We have communion there. But there are no Second Temple tombs in that area. The one that is on display for people to see, yes, it is a tomb, but it's not a newly hewn tomb. It's a classic Old Testament tomb.
Now, you mentioned a theological bias for choosing this other site for Christ's tomb. What would that bias have been? I know from a cursory reading of the archaeology of the times that there was a lot of revisionist thinking going on, and a lot of it stemmed, I think, from German archaeology back in the 1880s and 1890s. What was the theology that made him decide, well, there's probably a better site out there? Do you know?
Well, it's primarily a Catholic versus a Protestant issue. Even though the Holy Sepulchre Church is basically maintained and run by a number of denominations, Roman Catholic, Greek Orthodox, Syrian Orthodox, Coptic, you name it, even Ethiopians, these denominational people can't get along. It's interesting that the little Arab family for literally centuries actually owns the keys of the church because these denominations can't get along. But in the 19th century, at the about 1881, a guy named Gordon, general actually, a British officer, actually was standing on the walls of the Turkish walls right near the Damascus Gate, and he looked out to the north and saw what it was called, what he thought what looked like a rocky scarp with a skull look to it because of the erosion. So this sort of precipitated further investigation, although this idea that perhaps the tomb of Christ was this far north outside the old city today, even Condor and Kitchener about 20 years before, they were explorers as well. They suggested that this perhaps would be the area of Jesus' tomb. Mm-hmm. So lo and behold, I think motivated by, you know, those Catholics and those Greek Orthodox, they're all wrong, and let's just try to find a new site, a better site, maybe an authentic site for the time of the tomb of Christ. I think that's what led to the development of this, what is now the Garden Tomb.
Well, they probably felt they were being more correct scientifically, more honest research in picking that location. Because I'm sure the view of the Catholic Church and these other groups would have been that they're a little more prone to legend and exaggeration and so forth. They wanted to be scientific and rational about their choice. Was Helena, now Helena was the mother of Constantine, who was the emperor of the Eastern Empire at the time. Was that not serious archaeology by our standards probably, but do you think she was serious about being accurate in what she reported and what she built and what she found?
Well, she would build other churches such as Bethlehem, and I think her aim was to commemorate the locations of the events of Christ, whether it be his birth, the Church of Nativity in Bethlehem, or his death here in the Holy Sepulchre. So she basically was building this church on an area where Hadrian apparently built a temple. He wanted, of course, to destroy anything that had to do with the Christian faith. So he actually did us a favor by building a temple on this site, destroying any evidence or any link to the time of Christ and certainly to this possible area of where he was buried. So by doing that, it seems as if it gave Helena, when she came two centuries later, sort of an idea of where the tomb of Christ actually was, because Hadrian destroyed it himself.
You know, this really explains a lot, because you look at Hadrian and Roman efforts to expunge the Israelites, record of them, you know, they tear down the temple and destroy, and then later comes Islam through the area, and then the Crusaders, who had a whole different perspective on what Christianity was all about. And is it any wonder that things are so hard to find, that is tangible evidence, archaeological artifacts, writings, written records of any kind, to substantiate the faith, that is to provide all the details, to fill in the blanks in what we see in Scripture. I think that may go a long way toward explaining that. There was a real hate for these people, wasn't there?
There really was. And yet it sort of does us the favor of seeing the strife, if you will, back in these early centuries between whether it be Christians or Romans, or essentially, and eventually, I should say, at the Holy Sepulchre Church. This church was destroyed and rebuilt for the last 1,700 years by Christians, Crusaders, destroyed by Muslims. Back and forth it went. But so that's why we sort of have a hodgepodge. When you go into the church today, it's like, well, there's the Syrian area, there's the Roman Catholic area, here's the rotunda controlled by these people. It's an interesting church, but I even showed, I think on my blog, a picture of what is called kochim. It's a Hebrew word, means niche. These niche tombs actually are present, as I mentioned earlier, in the lower reaches, and even about 50 feet away from the traditional tomb today. You can actually see this these two niche tombs called Kokim. When you ask a Jewish archaeologist, however, like Gabi Barkai, who was an old professor of mine, but a leading voice, authority in archaeology of Jerusalem, when you ask him, someone who does not have a bias, of course, being Jewish, he doesn't really care whether the Catholics are right or, quote-unquote, the Protestants are right, he would certainly definitively say that the Holy Sepulchre, in the evidence that we find there, in the presence of these Second Temple tombs, is certainly the leading site for the tomb of Christ.
Are there tombs still available that would resemble tombs from 2,000 years ago? In other words, with some sort of a stone or a door, a closing mechanism to illustrate how that rolling the stone might have worked? Is there anything, maybe even just a model, so that we would get some idea of how that happened?
Well, it's a good question, because right outside the King David Hotel, it's in West Jerusalem, right outside the Old City, there is a tomb, a Second Temple tomb, that still has a rolling stone intact. Hmm. It's actually not a site at all visited by tourists. It's actually almost adjacent to an alley between one building and the King David Hotel, and yet it's a site that's collecting weeds, and it's just not kept up at all. But it's interesting that there is actually evidence of a pretty standard Second Temple tomb intact with a rolling stone.
Well, how big is this stone? How easily moved do you suppose that stone would be?
This stone was about 4 feet high and about a foot wide in width.
Mm-hmm.
It had a little trap. It was used. Another tomb actually found up in the Carmel region. It was when the Israelis were widening the road between the Jezreel Valley and the other western side of the Carmel Range. They actually found a Second Temple tomb as well. That's a really good picture of a standard type of tomb that Christ probably was buried in. So there are a few tombs here and there. I think of about 700, and I might be off in my count because I'm sure others have been found, but of about 700 Second Temple tombs, only about 5 or 6 actually had an intact rolling stone as a part of them. Most likely the stone itself was damaged or broke or even reused in a different way, but there are some examples. And even at the Garden Tomb, there's a rolling stone there. And it's interesting to put the two together. And even though I think our good British friends who maintain and run the Garden Tomb site, even though they are not definitive themselves, they have a wonderful site that helps us reflect upon really the true meaning of Easter, and in that the location maybe of the tomb of Christ isn't what is necessarily important. It's the fact that in the voice of the angels, he is not here, he is risen. I think that's the primary
amen.
About it all.
You make the point in your blog that you're not interested in worshiping the site, but the person, the person of Christ.
Right.
So, yeah.
And a lot of people do that. That's the first impression our tourists get when they walk into the Holy Sepulchre. You know, people are kissing the rock that supposedly where Jesus' body was laid and then wrapped before being placed in the tomb. And the place almost seems to be worshipped more than the person. And I think we have it backwards there. It should be just the opposite.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and John addresses it nicely on his blog. And we will post our conversation in the audio archives here on Broken Road Radio a little bit later today. And we'll include a link to John's website. Biblical Israel Tours really has a lot of great information, and you can is the blog on that site, or is it a different site, John?
Well, the blog, it's interesting that you asked that question, because actually tonight I'm uploading the new version of my website, which will integrate my blog on WordPress with my new site, which is being actually built on WordPress. So,
okay.
This week, hopefully, they'll be one of the same locations, so people can check out my blog as well as the website at the same location.
It's biblicalisraeltours.com, and you'll find a link in our audio archives under this morning show, this date on the 26th of March, and John's conversation. John, as always, it's been a delight to have you. We're better off for your visit. We've learned something today. And the subject of tombs of Well, more than passing interest, shall we say, especially this week at this time of the year. So much happened during Holy Week then. There's so much to talk about. And certainly it all culminates with not the crucifixion, but with the resurrection. And he's risen, and well, what can you say after that? That kind of says the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I certainly want to greet your listeners with a happy Easter and hope that this week will be a significant week spiritually for each of you as you contemplate and reflect and appreciate all the work, the accomplished work of Christ on the cross. But as you said, sir, it's the resurrection that gives us the hope of our faith.
Amen. John, thanks so much. Have a good week, and we'll look forward to talking to you next week, okay?
Thank you.
Reverend Dr. John DeLancey from Glenshaw, Pennsylvania this morning. Kate Miner sings for us on a Broken Road Radio Tuesday.